Yeah, here's another little phrase. Fess up when you mess up. And what that means, own it, don't explain it.
Give us an illustration. What's the difference between owning it and explaining it?
One is that I was wrong. It was my fault. Or I take my ownership of my part in this and not explain why I did as a diversion, but that I own my mistake.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's edition of the Lead Like Jesus podcast. This is Karen Conley. I am thrilled to welcome back a familiar guest to our podcast, someone that I have so many questions for every time we're able to have a conversation. Phil Hodges, welcome to the podcast.
Well, it's my delight to be back, Ms. Karen.
Well, I have enjoyed every time that I've had a chance to be at a Lead Like Jesus event to spend time with you and your wife, Jane. You bring so much wisdom to the table. We are thrilled to have you back today. And the topic that we're going to focus on today is an effective apology. That might not be the topic that every leader is running to learn about, but they really need to. Phil, I want you to help us maybe by setting the stage of answering the question, why is it important for leaders to be willing to apologize?
Well, it's one of those effective or ineffective aspects of being a human being in any organization or any situation that we're not going to always do things 100% right. And when we're in those circumstances, either as an individual or as a leader of other people, we're going to have a choice to make as to what to do with our own mess ups. We can do them well and build confidence, or we can do them poorly and build anxiety and a lack of trust in those people that are going to look to us not only today but tomorrow to help them move to a common place that we want to go to. It's kind of a critical piece of personal proficiency and also one that's important to have as a cultural aspect of what kind of environment are we setting up to allow for corrections to be made quickly, or to be having to discover defects rather than just deal with them in the right time.
We're going to talk about how to make an effective apology, but sometimes the how doesn't help if we don't understand the why. You mentioned the dichotomy of an effective apology can give the people that we know confidence, or it can give them a combination of anxiety and a lack of trust. Maybe you could flesh that out for us just a little bit more so we really understand what is at stake.
I think from a leadership standpoint, Karen, is the thing that is modeled in front of others and that they experience from a leader is that which they most likely to try and attempt to do as well. And I would say with kids, if a parent, in fact, is willing to get out of their role and apologize when it's appropriate to a child, they may be a little bit more willing to confess something when it's their turn. And that's the business of an environment of trust. It'll have to go two ways. And I think you can broaden that out into an organization or any other situation is that if there is an openness to the vulnerability is the word that people use, but I think transparency is a better one, that we do know that none of us on this earth are perfect. Will we make perfect decisions or satisfy everyone perfectly? And that we will have these things, but what do we do with them as an issue of character and as an issue of respect and relationships with others? It's a very delicate place to be and one that has long-term impacts for the relationships.
Phil, we know that we should apologize. Most of us, that's not new information. But somehow in our humanity, we can sometimes get turned around, especially when it comes to this topic of leadership. Even as you're mentioning in a parent-child relationship, there's sometimes that you can think, no, I'm the adult here. I should be right. And so it might be a form of weakness to apologize to my child. And you just really threw that paradigm out the door. But if a leader's listening right now, and maybe there's some tension in the office or in their home, where are the places that maybe the leader would justify not apologizing. Where are those places that the common things that happen in a leader's mind that would keep them maybe in that place of going, no, I shouldn't do that?
Well, I have some trouble with issues of when not to apologize, just because the reasons I think are most prevalent are really potentially issues of pride and fear.
Okay, absolutely.
If I can justify not apologizing because I don't want other people to lose faith in my leadership, it's all about me and an image that I'm trying to maintain, as opposed to giving any respect to their ability to grow and learn from my mistakes. That, you know, is sort of feeding my own false image of leadership, which is that I have to be right all the time, and that I have to be strong to the point of just taking every problem inward and not releasing it to respecting others to deal with it.
And those two examples right there, those two statements, if you were a leader right now and the thought going through your mind is, I'm supposed to be right, I'm the leader, I'm the one in charge, that may be something that you need to revisit and go, okay, really, what is the core thought behind that? Is that my pride or is that fear? And the same, a secondary topic to really evaluate. And again, self-evaluation is hard, but that's how we grow. That's how we become a better leader, is to go, okay, do I always feel like I have to have the answer and I have to be right? Maybe God has put other people on this team and this is something we are to do together. And it is not a weakness, but it's actually a strength for me to invite other people in.
Boy, do I agree with that particular part, Karen, is one thing. And taking it back into Jesus's example, he never had to apologize, but he certainly had context for his own work. John 17, the things he prays back to the Father is something been important, where he said, I glorified you by doing the work you set before me to do. That was all the work that could be done, and that was other people's work as well. But in doing the work that we're put to do as leaders, there's going to be an aspect of it that is going to be results, again, in relationships. And if I can build trust in my desire to do the right thing, but also willingness for people to call attention to things where I might have missed the boat or I haven't connected, but if we have some openness, then we have the ability to grow and to do the right thing together. It's tough, and it probably doesn't give you the kind of press that you may want from those who are looking to tear things down, but it builds character in relationship with the people.
Phil, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking of that contrast, that sometimes it's pride that really does trip us up and keeps us from humbling ourselves and admitting that we're wrong and asking someone to forgive us. But it's also kind of in a backwards way. There are times where fear would keep us from apologizing. How would you speak to that leader? They're not maybe struggling with pride, but there's a fear factor involved of what may be lost if they admit that they were wrong, or how that may negatively reflect back on them. What would you say to that leader that's struggling from more of a fear perspective?
Well, I would say that taking counsel of your fears is not a good place to lead from. Dealing with what do I fear, and then taking fear to the place where it needs to go, and that is to place, you know, something that you're confident in. And fear is the complete absence of the kind of leadership that Jesus participated in, spoke of in any kind of way. And fear-driven leadership is going to have a cost to it, both to the anxiety of the leader, blind spots that are created because we don't reveal where we don't know, and the whole thing goes along much harder, if ever, in the way it should go. So we talk about edging God out as an overall problem, and the two aspects of that being pride and fear. And I would say fear is probably the most potent one, that we need to take our fears to the place where they can be resolved. And that is in the fact that we are confident in the fact that we are forgiven, and we are also loved, and we are also called to work with the resources we're given through Christ. It is a topic that I would spend too much time on, but you've got to ask yourself, what am I afraid of?
Absolutely.
If it has something to do with yourself, you probably don't want to lead others out of that.
And really, that does obviously not to be, that's the type of thing that's a one-on-one conversation. You need to find somebody that is in your sphere that you trust, that has wisdom to maybe help you process through that. Phil, let's talk on a real practical level. If we're talking about how important it is as a leader to be able to apologize, help us to know what makes a good apology.
Let me give you a couple of things that have come to mind. And one of them, an effective apology has a short shelf life. And unless it's delivered in a timely fashion, it'll start to spoil pretty quickly. So that one thing about an apology is as quick as there is, the facts have been verified and something has been determined that needs to an apology, do it quickly. Do it quickly purely on the basis of the fact that if time elapses and individuals find out that you knew about it at this time and it took 2 weeks to apologize, they're going to turn something that may have been a momentary weakness into a wickedness. There was something you were trying to position in between the action and the apology that was not to their best interest. So to the degree that it's done quickly, I think is important, an important aspect to keep it effective.
If you're on a treadmill, you might not be able to write that down, but you just said that if it's left too long, if you don't make that apology quickly, it turns something that was a weakness into a wickedness. Oh, Phil, as you say that, I can just think how just delays sometimes allow that something that was small explodes into something that was major. And so that, do not miss that. So an effective apology, a good apology, needs to have a short shelf life. I love that. Anything else that makes a good apology, Phil?
Yeah, here's another little phrase. Fess up when you mess up. And what that means, own it, don't explain it.
Give us an illustration. What's the difference between owning it and explaining it?
One is that I was wrong. It was my fault. Or I take my ownership of my part in this and not explain why I did as a diversion, but that I own my mistake. Too many apologies morph into explanations of why I should be given a pass on something, rather than getting to the point that I really deeply regret what I did because of the impact it had, not just that it was revealed. To me, is a key aspect to it, which breeds either character and confidence in and results, or trying to say that we're really just sorry it happened, but I don't own my part of it. So an effective apology would be one that is able to deal with that in that particular way.
So when someone says, I'm really sorry that it made you feel that way.
Yeah.
How does that work as an apology, Phil?
Not so good.
Why not? Because I've heard that a million times before. What does that rob the hearer of when you approach it that way?
It robs any level of accountability on the part of the erring party and saying it was all your fault for not understanding me or what have you. I'm sorry we had... It's a complete dodge.
Complete dodge. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, these are fantastic. If you're keeping track, we've talked about what makes a good apology, a short shelf life, and number two, fess up when I mess up. And that means own it, don't explain it. These are fantastic. My son is graduating this week, and I wish when he was about 4, I had started talking to him about these specific principles because they can apply all the way along the age spectrum. Anything else that you would say is an essential ingredient to a good apology?
Don't overburden the individual that's hearing it with having a completely accepting and yielding response. Maybe what you did even hurt more than you knew. Or maybe if it's just new news, there's a need to process it. So I'd say at the other end of the apology is grace and forgiveness on your part for the way in which people respond. They may not let you off the hook, and they may have to process it themselves. But I think that, to me, is the other part that results in relationships. An apology is one of those key aspects of continuing relationships for the future. An explanation doesn't give the other individual anything.
And I think so often we can, if we're really on our game and we're really trying to do things the right way, we can go to people and keep a short record of wrongs. We can own it. But that third component of really extending grace to the person who's hearing it and not expecting them to respond perfectly takes this to a whole new level. To the, really, the relationship is the bottom line. That's what you are trying to restore. So for you to execute properly, but then come back and tell them they did not, really, you've missed the whole point.
Yeah. And then, Karen, there's a pre-step to this, and this is really, as I go forward into an apology, is to really accept the grace and accept the forgiveness that God has already given us. I'll give you one, just as embedded in one story that I found. In Luke 15 is the story of the prodigal son. And there's a verse that just said, and when he came to his senses, he went back to his father, and he said, I have sinned against God and you. And he went to the degree that he had realized those errors on his part. And I think when we go to God for the grace and the forgiveness he's given us, we're able to even extend it to others that they may need in the way they're going to respond to the things that's newly revealed to them, or they tell us about how difficult it was to learn we were talking about.
That's a great analogy. And obviously, one of the reasons the prodigal son was told to us from what we can learn from that whole encounter. There is a case that is discussed in the Lead Like Jesus Revisited book that deals with this very topic. I wonder if you could take just a minute to explain the Lincoln case to us and apply it to our listeners today.
Okay, thank you, Karen. There's a case in the book that talks about an incident where Lincoln was alone on a Saturday afternoon after having been taking up all the issues of the war, having to make all kinds of decisions. And the last visitor of the day was Colonel Scott. And I'll read this little thing to you and make a comment at the end. It said, during the Civil War, Lincoln was visited by Colonel Scott, a commander of troops guarding the Capitol. Scott's wife had drowned in the Spirit and steamship collision in Chesapeake Bay. He had appealed to the regimental command for leave to attend her burial and to comfort his children, but he was denied. He took his request to the Secretary of War and was refused. In his ultimate appeal, Scott was the last visitor allowed to see Lincoln on the late afternoon on Saturday night. As Scott recalled, Lincoln listened to his story and exploded. I have to have no rest. Is there no hour or spot when or where I am to escape these constant calls? Why do you follow me here with such business as this? Why do you not go to the War Office where they're in charge of all matters of papers and transportation? Scott told Lincoln that Stanton had refused. The president replied with equal fervor that during the time of war, everyone has burdens to bear. He sided with Stanton and denied Scott's request. Lincoln again suggested Scott go to the War Department, and if they did not help him, Scott was to bear his burden until the war was over. And then it said, Colonel Scott returned to his barracks brooding. Now, there's a vision of a great man in a bad moment. But here's what happened, and this is where the greatness really comes out. It said, early the next morning, Scott heard a rap at the door. It was the president. He took Scott's hands and apologized, saying, I had no right to treat a man with rudeness who has offered his life to his country, much more a man in such great affliction. I have had a regretful night and now come to beg your forgiveness. He had arranged through Stanton for Scott to go to his wife's funeral. And what I found in that story, Karen, was the business that I spoke of and we've learned from was Lincoln had all kinds of reasons that he could have explained to Scott why he had behaved so badly, but he just owned what it was, did it quickly, and in fact made a recourse for the individual the best he could. That's the true greatness of a great servant leader.
And such a picture, it's never the wrong time to do the right thing. That's a powerful example from our history. Well, Phil, I've just taken so much from this particular podcast. In recap, if you are someone who's like me, I like to have my ducks in a row. When you're making an apology, have a short shelf life. Fess up when you mess up. And don't overburden the hearer. And these are all fantastic takeaways from our conversation today. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my great pleasure.
We would love for you to get any more information that you would like on leadership and leadership development. Please go to leadlikejesus.com. And you can also pick up a most recent copy of Lead Like Jesus Revisited. We'll see you next time.